Let's begin with a few brief moments of review. So after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot, or generations headings, and we've talked about this every week. I'll just take a few minutes just to, perhaps for some who haven't participated before. And so you have the prologue, the origin of the world, and then you have the origins of the nations, so 5 toledot for the origins of the nations, and then you have 5 toledot for the origins of Israel. So you have Terah, Ishmael, Isaac, Esau, and Jacob. And it's in that 10th toledot, or generations heading, that we find our story tonight. Digging in a little bit more detail into the story of Jacob, you have chapter 37. So it starts in chapter 37 in verse 2, and you have division in the family. All of the brothers are together, but divided, and Joseph is sold into slavery. Then you have chapter 38, which tells the story of Judah apart from his brothers. So the brothers are divided, and you have the story of Judah apart from his brothers. Then you have in chapter 39 through 41, you have the story of Joseph apart from his brothers. So the story of Joseph in Egypt. And then in chapters 42 through 47, you have the story of 3 journeys down to Egypt. And in the over the course of these 3 journeys, the family comes back together again. So chapter 42 is the first journey, and then the second journey is found in chapter 43 through 45, and that second journey now includes Benjamin as well as the ten sons of Leah and the concubines. And then 46 through 47, the third journey, includes the whole family. And then in chapter 48 through 50, you have the passing of Jacob and Joseph. Chapter 42, as I mentioned, relates the first of 3 journeys to Egypt. And the second journey follows the basic structure as the first, with 7 scenes in each story. So the 7 basic themes are these. Scene 1 is a journey to Egypt. Scene 2 is an arrival in Egypt. Scene 3 is a first audience with Joseph. Scene 4 is the brothers in custody. Scene 5 is a second audience with Joseph. Scene 6 is a departure from Egypt. And scene 7 is a report by the sons back to Jacob. So both the first and the second journey follow this basic pattern. And the last time that we were in Genesis, last week, we covered scenes 3 and 4 of the second journey from chapter 43, verse 26, through chapter 44 and verse 13. And tonight we're going to attempt, if possible, to work through the last 3 scenes of the second journey, though it's also possible we won't make it quite that far. And so we pick up our story in chapter 44 and verse 14. And Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house. So they had had the silver cup placed in Benjamin's sack, and Joseph's steward had come and made this tremendous accusation against them, and all the brothers had come back together. And Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. And there's 2 things to note about this. Number 1, they left the city, this is a quote, they left the city as the men, actually it's not a quote, they left the city as the men. This turn of phrase is very significant. Even if everything seems to be falling apart, the brothers are being brought together. And this is the quote that I was mentioning. As the narrative moves to its most telling episode, the narrator, who commonly refers to the brothers as the men, so in chapter 43, throughout chapter 43 and 44, the brothers are referred to simply as the men 9 times. In chapter 45, we're going to find that it speaks of the brothers in verse 1, verse 3, verse 4, verse 15, verse 24, verse 16, and already here in chapter 44 and verse 14, this is the turning point where it turns from just speaking of the men, as generic a name as possible. They're now being referred to as Judah and his brothers, and then they're going to be referred to as the brothers of Joseph. So there's a shift in terminology that gives us sort of an advanced preview. There's going to be a shift in the story. And pay very careful attention to the way that people are described in Old Testament stories, because sometimes we're not able to identify with precision what the significance is, but there almost always is a significance. And if we pay careful attention, it's usually possible to determine at least the general drift of that. And so that's the first point, that the men are now being described as Judah and his brothers. And then in chapter 45, this is going to become even more pronounced as the whole terminology that's used shifts. And they fall down before him. So previously they bowed down. Now they fall down. It's a different, more extreme word. They're falling on their faces before Joseph. So we have chapter 44, verse 15. So Joseph now accuses them. So they come back to Joseph's house and they fall on their face. They don't say anything initially. They give Joseph the first word. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that ye have done? Wot ye not that such a man as I can certainly divine?" And the brothers are totally helpless. You can just imagine what's going through their mind, because all they know is that here's this Egyptian taskmaster who seems to be out to get, not taskmaster, but ruler, who has all the power there is in Egypt. He's all powerful compared to them. They're completely helpless, and he seems out to get them. I talked about this in more detail last week. He says, "I can certainly divine," and it's the word that typically means to enchant. It's something we talked about in more detail last week, so we won't revisit all of that ground tonight, but it basically means to do enchantments, which the children of Israel were later strictly prohibited from doing. Earlier on in Joseph's life, he had made it a matter of conscience to be very strict about letting Pharaoh know, "It's not my power that's telling you this dream. This is something that comes from God." And now he's become much more callous about that. And in order to prove a point to, you know, in order to accomplish his goals with his brothers, he's able to even talk about using sorcery to determine who's stolen something out of his house. And he's talking this way in front of everyone who works for him. And so he had previously wanted to maintain a very careful testimony about this, but over time in his position of power, he became a lot less careful about this sort of language. And I think that's something that is not seen as a good development in Joseph, that he's becoming more callous in that way. And so now, any questions up to this point on the first few verses there? Questions? And as we're going along, if you want to raise your hand in the meanwhile, and when I get to a stopping point, even before I ask for questions, you can just have your hand up, and I will I'll let Josh know when I'm ready to take that, and then we can unmute you there, so that way you don't have to try to find the button right when I first mention it. So let's see. So verse 16. And Judah said, so Judah comes to the lead. He's going to be in the forefront throughout this story. This really shows the transformation in Judah's character. And this is really very significant. And Judah said, so he gives his first defense. And Judah said, "What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found." And so Judah recognizes that he's powerless. He knows there's nothing that he can do. He doesn't even know how to start talking about it to Joseph. But the brothers have already recognized, if you were to go back to chapter 42 and verse 21 on their first journey, and they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us." So when he's saying God has found out the iniquity of thy servants, he's not saying God found out that we stole the cup. We really stole the cup. He's making a general comment. He recognizes how helpless he is. There's no way he can argue with Joseph about whether or not they really stole the cup, given the power that Joseph has and given the total lack of power that they have. trying to defend themselves against the charge of stealing the cup is going to be a futile cause. And so he just knows that God has found out their iniquity, and he knows something is going on that's bigger than anything that he can understand. Moving on to the next verse, and he said, and so Joseph responds. So Judah just says, let's all be your slaves. And it almost seems like his first thing is to offer such an extreme sacrifice that maybe Joseph will be motivated to compassion. So to offer a disproportionate, in a sense, punishment, let's all be your slaves, so that maybe Joseph will come back with something more reasonable. That seems to be maybe the direction he's heading, because directly saying, we didn't steal the cup. Well, I mean, on the face of it, the evidence seems overwhelming. And it seems like the brothers may even think that Benjamin did steal the cup. You know, the evidence seems pretty strong against him. There's no, you know, part of the story where Benjamin's, you know, vociferously denying it. So they seem to be acting on the assumption that Benjamin actually did steal this cup, because there's never any refusal of that. We only know that because we know the story. They didn't know the backstory. So Joseph knows that Benjamin didn't steal it, but the brothers, Judah in particular, likely it seems thinks that they are in fact, they did take, one of them took this cup. But Judah knows he's not guilty of taking the cup, but he knows he is guilty regarding Joseph, and that his sin is finding him out, even though he didn't commit this particular crime. But Joseph maintains a hard line. He said, God forbid that I should do so, but the man in whose hand the cup is found, he shall be my servant. And as for you, get you up in peace unto your father. And so they're offered the chance to get off scot-free, and with double silver in their sacks to boot. So they already had the double silver. That hasn't been mentioned. And so Joseph has put them in this dilemma. Are they going to leave Benjamin behind and go home without him? Are they willing to continue to divide the family up? Will they abandon Benjamin as they had once turned on Joseph? And so we're going to see. And so then moving on, so any questions on the first few verses? Anything? Is there anyone? And so Judah then responds in verses 18 through 34 with the single longest speech in Genesis. And this is very, very significant. In Hebrew narrative, the amount of time that's given to someone in terms of the length of their speeches that are recorded is a very significant factor in determining their significance in the story. So the fact that this is the single longest speech in all of Genesis is very important, is very, very important for understanding the centrality of this story in this particular episode in the overall structure of Genesis. And it demonstrates a comprehensive change in Judah's character, and yet a careful examination. So it demonstrates the way in which Judah's character has changed. But if you pay careful attention to the details, as I hope we'll be able to do tonight, then we'll also see the ways in which Joseph's character needed to be changed. And in fact, it seems like, at least the way that I read it, it seems like it also convicts Joseph of changes that he needs to make in his own response to the overall situation. And so we'll talk about some of the details of that here in a minute. So it starts in verse 18. There's an introduction where Judah basically asks permission to speak. Then Judah came near unto him, that is, unto Joseph, and said, O my Lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not thine anger burn against thy servant, for thou art even as Pharaoh. So Judah recognizes that Joseph is in this position of incredible power, that Joseph can basically do whatever he wants, and that there's nothing that Judah can do about it. So throughout this whole speech, he's very, very humble and he's very, very careful, what he says to be as, take as much blame as possible and not to be needlessly provoking. And he recognizes that Joseph has the same sort of arbitrary life and death power that Pharaoh himself has. And so the speech begins in 19, verse 19, with a review of past events. So there's no record that Joseph says, okay, Judah, you can go ahead and speak. Judah just plows right on ahead. And the first portion of the speech is in 19 through 23. My Lord asked his servant, saying, have ye a father or a brother? And we said unto my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age, a little one. And his brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother, and his father loveth him. And thou saidst unto thy servants, bring him down unto me, that I may set my eyes upon him. And we said unto my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. And thou saidst unto thy servant, except your youngest brother come down with you, ye shall see my face no more. And the first thing to note is that Judah's speech as a whole is dominated by his father. It's dominated by Jacob. So Judah mentions the word father no less than 14 times, twice 7 times in this speech. Not only that, but he mentions the word father in the first sentence of the speech in verse 19. He starts with the father, and in verse 34, he ends with the father. So it's father from beginning to end, and it's 14 times throughout. So he is very, very focused on Jacob. But there's something, one of the things in Hebrew narrative that's very fascinating is the way that we learn things. As events are told, and then events are retold, and then events are told again, sometimes we learn the way that certain figures are reshaping the truth to suit their own ends. So we learn about ways people can distort the truth. So Potiphar's wife, she tells her story of what took place twice. She twists the truth both times, and in both times she's reshaped the narrative to fit her own purposes. So that's one thing that can happen when stories are repeated. Another thing that can happen when stories are repeated is that we can learn bits of the story we didn't know before that put the whole thing in a slightly different light. So we learn something we didn't realize before, and that gives us another perspective on the story as a whole. And that's one of the things that takes place here. So I mentioned earlier that an underlying theme a few weeks ago is the tension between Joseph. Joseph's determined to see Benjamin, and Jacob is determined to keep Benjamin. And it's vitally important to note we weren't told earlier in the story that Joseph's brothers warned Joseph of the risk of to the father of bringing Benjamin down. And we said unto my Lord in verse 22, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. That part of the story hasn't been told before. But Judah is not twisting the truth because he's relating their previous speech to Joseph himself. So he's not going to risk making things up when he's pleading for his brother's life. And he's speaking, he's reminding them of their previous conversation. So we shouldn't read that as Judah inventing a detail, but this is a detail that's been withheld from the reader. So the narrator didn't tell us this earlier, but now we're finding this out. And just as when we're reading the story of how Joseph is treating his brothers, and we find, oh, Joseph is going in private to weep. Well, that recharacterizes him because we realize actually Joseph cares a lot about his brothers. He's not this hard, bitter person. He's emotionally moved by this whole situation. He's very conflicted about what he's doing. And so that reshapes the portrayal of him in a positive light, and it adds a level of complexity to his character. But from the other direction, from a more negative direction, this also makes him a more complex character, because we find that Joseph had already been told, oh, if Benjamin leaves, then our father is going to die. And Joseph demands that Benjamin come anyways, which means that Joseph was so set on his plan of seeing Benjamin that he was willing to risk his father's life to see it come to fruition. And only now at this point do we see that Joseph has been willing to risk his father's life in order to test his brothers to his satisfaction and to fulfill his desire to see Benjamin. And this is in many ways the turning point of the story when we realize just how complex a figure Joseph really is. And his very urgency to know whether or not they had changed reveals how much he needed to change as well. And his motives were undoubtedly extremely complex. So he's not seeking revenge necessarily. It's pretty clear from his tears and from his later care for them that revenge isn't what he's seeking, but he's so set on proving that they've changed that he's willing to risk his father's life to be able to really know what his brother's hearts are like. And in so doing, he's ignored something he himself has been overlooking in his own heart. Nathan Axfield commented on the chat that it reminds me of police shows, detectives listening to different people, putting the picture together and asking to hear people tell their side of the story again. That you hear one side of the story, but then you hear something else, and then you go back and you listen to the first side again, and maybe a detail that didn't stick out to you before now becomes clear. That's the crucial detail. And that's one of the things that takes place in Hebrew narrative in the Old Testament, is the narrator almost never, very, very rarely, gives an explicit characterization gives explicit commentary. Instead, what takes place is you find this telling and retelling and a little detail here and a little detail here, and it's an incredible and very concise way of giving us a vision of the overall complexity of reality, the way that, you know, our motivations as human beings is very complex. So I'm going to paste in to the chat here an application question, and then I'll go ahead and read it. How might we be tempted to become so focused on the change that needs to take place in others that we begin to ignore the change that needs to take place in our own hearts? So how might we be tempted to become so focused on the change or that needs to take place in others that we begin to ignore the change that needs to take place in our own hearts? And it's important to be clear, Joseph wasn't wrong that his brothers needed to change. He was right about that. And it wasn't wrong for Joseph to seek to figure out and to test his brothers. But Joseph had become so obsessed with this project of testing his brothers that he was willing to subject his father to risk in order to accomplish this goal. And so I see John Trotter has his hand up. Josh, do you want to give him the floor?
All right, you should be set. I'm having trouble unmuting you. I think you'll probably have to unmute yourself.
Hello.
There we go.
Hi. I just more have an example, I guess, than an answer. I just heard it said that Judas, the one who betrayed Jesus, he seemed to be the most concerned out of all the disciples about giving to the poor and not wasting money, and yet he was the one who was helping himself to the bag all the time. So, I don't know, just kind of an example how he was worried about others not considering others' needs, and he was definitely, that was like a source or a blind spot or something he purposely ignored in his own life.
Yeah, I think that could be, you know, there can be so many different ways this can show up in. You know, one of the things that this can show up in is in theological disputes. that sometimes people can be some so passionate. I'm getting some comments here, so I'll read the comments in a minute. We can become so passionate about the perceived errors of others that we can use that to justify perhaps an unloving or a hard-hearted or hard-spirited response on our part. And it's like Jesus said to the Pharisees, it's not that these other matters of the law, tithing the mint, anise, and cumin, or cumin, are unimportant. It's not that you shouldn't be concerned about those things, but that you're using your concern about those things to justify failures in greater areas. And that's really what it comes down to. So some people commented, as a parent, this is a challenge that I face. And then the Sumis, keeping our eyes on ourselves instead of God, pride, bitterness, envy. And Elisha mentioned, we may feel like the sins of others are greater than our own sin. And all of these things are part of this story, I think. And I think the way it shows up maybe more clearly is when someone hurts us in a way that is significant and serious, and we have a genuine need to discover if they have changed. And yet we can become so obsessed at testing their change that we begin to allow our own spiritual walk to atrophy, because all our focus is on, have they really changed or not? Have they met this bar or not? And that can be deeply unhealthy for us spiritually, even if it may be necessary to a certain extent. And it's not that it's wrong to try to determine whether others have really changed or not. That may be necessary, but we can be so focused on it that we may miss something in our own heart that potentially is even more important. Anyone else on that before we move on? All right. Moving on to verse 24. I am guessing we are not going to get to the end of chapter 45 tonight. Verse 24. And it came to pass that when we came up unto thy servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, go again and buy us a little food. And we said, we cannot go down. If a youngest brother be with us, then will we go down. But we may not see the man's face except our youngest brother be with us. And thy servant, my father, said unto us, ye know that my wife bare me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces, and I saw him not since. And if ye take this also from me, and mischief befall him, ye shall bring down my gray hairs with sorrow unto the grave. Verse 27, ye know that my wife bare me two sons. This is what Jacob is saying to Judah. And the very favoritism that had once led to hatred is now argued as a ground for mercy. Judah is now more identified with the perspective of his father than Joseph is. There's a quote here, Joseph so feels for his father that he begs to sacrifice for a brother more loved than himself. So Judah has so identified himself with the father's perspective on Benjamin that he is quoting Jacob saying to Judah, my wife bore me two sons, which excludes Judah and his full brothers altogether from the family. Jacob is obsessed with Joseph and Benjamin. And yet Judah is so identifying himself with Jacob's perspective that he's willing to sacrifice himself to save the son that Jacob would have preferred to be saved, even though that son wasn't Judah himself, which is really, really quite remarkable. And this is a little bit, it's not a direct application, but it does raise this question. And I think the connection is relevant. Let's see. I'll paste the application question in here. God does not have any favorite children. So God is not a bad father like Jacob, who, Jacob was very flawed as a father in that he had his two favorite sons and he really didn't care very much about the rest. So that is not a good thing, and God is not like that at all. But one way in which this same temptation that Judah overcame here can show up in our lives is when God chooses to use someone else, perhaps even someone who on the face of it seems less talented or even less deserving or perhaps even less faithful than we see ourselves as being, and God blesses them and doesn't bless us. So this could show up in so many different ways. It could show up as, you know, you're faithful to share the gospel all the time. And once were able to move about in public, you know, in the course of your life, you share the gospel with everyone that you meet and you go out on visitation. And yet you never seem to see any fruit from that. And someone else that you know isn't really all that faithful at all. And it's the person they share the gospel with that comes to church. The person they share the gospel with that gets saved. And there can be the temptation to feel aggrieved, as if I put the work in, God should reward my effort. I sowed seed for years, and they only sowed for one day, and why are they getting the same reward as I'm getting, seeing the same fruit as I'm seeing, or maybe even more fruit than I'm seeing? And there's something, Chrysostom, I forgot to look this up, but he has a great quote where he talks about, well, I'm not saying that I want more. So he puts this in the voice of another person. And he's saying, I'm not saying that I want, you know, to be more praised. I just want God to be praised through me. But if our concern is really for God to be praised, he goes on to point out, then you should be delighted that God is being praised, however that is taking place. And not so concerned about yourself. The way he worded it was just incredibly eloquent. And I did not think of that until just now. But we should be so delighted and so identified with the perspective of the Father that when his work is accomplished, we are happy about it, even when it doesn't take place through us. And I see we have some hands going up. So see. Sweetheart, Josh, can you unmute her?
Okay, you should be good to go. Well, I think you're going to... Yeah, there you go.
I'm unmuted. Maybe a little bit different than what you're saying, but I remember I was in full-time ministry for a lot of my early 20s, and I saw God giving everyone else a spouse and not me. And I remember there was the struggle to not be bitter, to not feel really discontent with where he had me right then because of him seeming to be blessing them and not me with what I desired most.
And that, yeah, I think that is applicable. Mike, and I think that is applicable because what happens is it's just this beautiful picture, even though some of the human details of the story were rather broken, it's still to be identified with the perspective of the Father, even if that is different from what we ourselves would have wanted. Mike and Cindy commented Jonah-esque, the prodigal son-esque, and the prodigal son's brothers-esque. The prodigal son really... That parable is the archetypical example of this sort of thing. I think that's, and Jonah as well, where there's a, you know, ultimately both of the sons are alienated from the father. And there's actually with Judah's willing to substitute himself for his younger brother, there's in the parable of the prodigal son, there's some intentional allusions back to the story about Judah. And we won't take the time to go into that, but I was just reading something the other day in which there's a couple link backs between the story of Judah and the prodigal son. There's actually, the story of the prodigal son is like this switchboard to so many narratives in Genesis where it's alluding here. And it works as a story in and of itself, even if you don't see the Old Testament connections. But, you know, Jesus is speaking to the scribes who knew the Old Testament backwards and forwards. So for people who knew these narratives, there are so, so many connections. And then we have a comment from Talia. We might be bitter if it doesn't make sense or seems illogical. And I think that is also a really good input, that sometimes, you know, there are things that happen that don't make sense to us, or things that just aren't fair. And, you know, really what happened to Judah and his brothers wasn't fair. It wasn't right that Benjamin should be preferred over all of his other brothers. It wasn't right that Jacob should care so little about what happened to Dinah. It wasn't right that Judah should basically ignore his other, that Jacob should ignore his other three wives and only just care about Rachel and her children. And yet, there is a lot of things that happen in life that aren't fair, and we're defined not by the unfair things that happen to us, but by the spirit in which we respond to those things. And we often have very little choice in the circumstances we're faced with, but where our character is tested and shaped is in the way we choose to respond and in the spirit with which we choose to respond. So I think that was a very good comment. But bitterness, scripture is clear from beginning to end. Bitterness is incredibly destructive. And sometimes even the more apparently justified it is, the more destructive it is. Because then it's easier just to allow it to grow and to grow and to grow and to grow. And we allow our entire life to be shaped by that thing that someone did to us or that thing that someone didn't do for us. And that becomes what defines our entire existence. Christy Tanaka commented, I think status at work could be a place for bitterness when other coworkers get praises or promotions, especially when you are just as hardworking. I think this can happen a lot. All of us know that promotions, when they come, are rarely fair. They very often happen because someone knows someone, or because someone happened to get someone else's notice at the right time, or because someone is related to someone, or because someone wants something from someone. And there's all of these things that happen that are very unjust. And Nate had another comment here. When sickness strikes a family member who seems to have done everything right, while people who live destructive lifestyles live longer or healthier. And we have a hand raised. Josh, can you give the floor to Christy as well?
All right. We're ready.
Okay. I was trying to think of an example. And I remember when our children were little, and we used to live in Port Orchard, and we would walk everywhere we went around town. People would stop us and say how wonderful Dr. Tanaka was. And no one said how wonderful I was. And all I did was, I was pregnant and I was vomiting and I changed diapers, and that's all I did for years. So that was really hard for me. And I'm sure other moms could relate to that.
Yeah, I think that's a common thing for moms especially to try to deal with, is that they're trying to support their husband and they're doing what God's called them to do. And yet sometimes it's the person being supported who sometimes, you know, isn't even maybe being as faithful as the wife who is at home, who's trying to be faithful and do all this work. And some, I'm not saying this about Dr. Tanaka and not about husbands in general, but just I've known families where the wife is long suffering and she's working really hard and she's trying to do everything right. And the dad is pretty much a layabout. I'm not, the family I'm thinking of, just for clarification, is not a family in this church. But someone I knew in a previous church where the wife, basically, there really wasn't anything you could criticize her for. And the husband, there wasn't really that much you couldn't criticize him for, to be honest. And yet so much of that was under the surface that he still got more attention than she did. And that's really been a struggle for her, because she's being faithful and he's doing a lot of things that are not faithful, and he still gets more attention and more notice for what he's doing. And yet bitterness is always destructive, even when it's justified. And God knows what he's doing when he calls us to walk through things that are difficult and unfair, And often God is most glorified when we're faithful in the most difficult of circumstances. Ashley made a comment again along that line, when a baby or pregnancy is still wanted and there is loss, and when others easily have unwanted babies, it can seem very unfair. And that's another perfect example. That there are so many things in life that are not fair, but when we can get to the point when we can genuinely take pleasure, genuinely identify ourselves with what others need and want, even if it runs contrary to what we need and want, that's when our hearts can really be free to see transformative things take place. There's an example from the life of Jonathan Edwards when the Great Awakening was taking place. When the Great Awakening was first taking place, there really wasn't, Jonathan Edwards' own preaching wasn't having that big of an effect at first. And there was someone else who came to town who everyone was praising his preaching. And Edwards' wife really struggled with wanting people to be converted under her husband's ministry and not be, it's not that she didn't want people to be converted, but everyone was, there were all this remarkable conversions with this other person. I forget his name now. I didn't take the time to look up the story, but this other person was seeing all this success and she knew how faithful her husband had been and she felt aggrieved, not on her own behalf, but for someone else, that it wasn't fair in their life. And she really struggled with being happy. It wasn't Whitfield. It was someone, I don't think it was Whitfield. I think it was someone else, maybe even before. It may have been a couple of different people. It was this ongoing issue. And yet over time, you know, Jonathan Edwards, God certainly was using him, but his greatest usefulness came in his writings, many of which he wrote after he had been kicked out of the church over something really silly. And they ended up being missionaries to the Indians on almost no salary out on the middle of the frontier. And he had the greatest theological, one of the greatest minds of American history, even by secular estimations. And he can't even retain the pastorate of a church. And he's, you know, forced out by powerful people to go be a missionary on the frontier, and really, you know, didn't seem like maybe a good fit for him. And yet anyways, I'm going in too many different directions. But the point was that she was tempted by that and she overcame that. And in reality, though she couldn't see it at the time, God was already powerfully using her husband in that way. So. Any other questions or comments on this? Well, one more thing on verse 28, and we are just about out of time. In verse 28, it says, "And the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces." And this is the first time that Joseph is learning what his father thought had happened to him. So this is another revelation. So Joseph is being reminded, so we're learning that Joseph was aware that it was risking his father's life to have Benjamin come. And the other element of this is that Joseph is now learning for the first time what his father thought had happened to him this whole time. And so there's no record that Joseph knew what story his brothers had told their father. He would have had no way of knowing that. But now, at this point, he learns that, and that's part of what breaks him down, and he stops trying to test his brothers and becomes reconciled to them. Any final comments before we're done? It's hard to believe that it already got to 7 o'clock. I didn't even get through like a third of the notes that I had, which is crazy. But we'll pick it up next week. Let's close in prayer. Thank you all for participating. Father, I come before you. I thank you for how good you are. Thank you for this time. I just pray, Father, Lord, that you'd fill our hearts with your word. Help us to be faithful to you, even in these trying circumstances, and give us strength to serve you. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.